so many beloved faces and some people I know a little less well. Is anyone new here for the first time? Welcome. Good to have you. You're going to get to hear about why we think we might have taken this move. We were ordained 4 days ago, so that's what we're going to share about. And are we looking for, what time is the usual ending time? Okay, thanks. So we had a few days to collect some thoughts to share with you, and these are thoughts that have been brewing for years, really. When I said, whose idea was this, a couple? He went, a couple years ago. But first I really want to begin and end with so much gratitude. I have to begin and end my talk with thank yous, because it's been such an amazing experience to come back here. We've been gone for a year. Back dipped in a few times, but the experience of being held by the Sangha immediately with so much kindness has just been remarkable. And it really gave me a clear, beautiful way to understand, you know, why we don't just plop down our cushion at home and do our little meditation there. It's there's a lot that we give each other, and there's a lot that everyone has given us of patience and generosity as we kind of fumble our way through this time. In fact, Jean put together a little program for our ordination, and what we chose to put on the back of it was a quote from the Buddha talking about Sangha, and he says, "Indeed, the whole of the holy life is fulfilled through spiritual friendship." And I've never felt that quite so much. And what I saw, this image came to me over the past week that is so clear and so beautiful of, you know, you hold a baby and you're just completely taking care of it, and there's ways that we hold things, but the way I experienced this, being held by the Sangha is with kind of two supports, maybe one on each end as we kind of are going like this to help us stay up. And one of the supports is accountability. And the other support, and the other bookend is support. And so it's just a space where we can take risks and we can tell the truth and we can fall down, and we've got accountability to the Sangha, and we've got the support. So, for example, after after a really humiliating first day of trying to move around in this, I have to try to kind of be myself, but not disparage anything, but it's very difficult, and so, you know, we were fumbling around and keeping everyone behind and dropping things, and That was Monday morning. Tuesday morning, we were like, we really didn't want to show up. It was very difficult to show up. So it's just a funny but true example of, you know, you don't not show up, and that's the accountability. That's the accountability. And then you show up, you know, and there's Jean, you know, behind me, helping me fold the cloth, and Dana next to Chuck, helping him learn how to put on this robe, and everyone in the room being kind and being patient. So we have the accountability and we have the support, and I just feel like I want to say, never take it for granted, because it's a beautiful gift. It's the gift of Sangha. So the big question for really the last couple years, people ask us, why ordain? And it's a very interesting, kind of not clear journey, I would say, that we, you know, started asking ourselves years ago, and why would anyone do that, and what does it really mean, and what's the difference, and, you know, what happens inside, because what you see on the outside is that the people who are ordained are going to the altar and offering incense in a certain way, and okay, you know, that didn't help us much find out and think about what it means. And so actually, for a number of years, I've been just sitting with the question and talking to people and reading and looking at myself and what my motivations might be. And there's two things. First, I would say, you know, there's a way in which I don't know how to answer that question. And there's the classic Buddhist truth that you really can't say anything, but you have to say something. And then there's value in all the inquiry. So I really did kind of over these past few years find two things that always rang true to me that were what I could call reasons for ordaining. And one of them is accountability. And that spreads a lot farther than accountability to the Sangha, but that's part of it. Accountability to the teachings and to my teacher and to the Sangha, but also to myself, to my community, to the worms, to the earth, just, you know, living in a way that I'm holding myself accountable. And you don't need this awkward cloth to do that whatsoever. It's like nothing that we do. We don't, it's not I need that to be accountable, but I actually feel that for me it's a support. You know, it's a reminder every morning of what's important to me, and it kind of keeps me a little bit, well, we'll see. My theory is that it's going to keep me, you know, it's going to help me sometimes when I'm just really want to be lazy, in the way of, especially now when things are so difficult in our country, sometimes it's just like, I just want to pull the covers over my head because it's too much. It's too much, and I've felt over the years that somehow for me wearing this robe is a way to help myself be accountable to all of it and to remind me who I am. So that's reason one. And the other one is kind of even harder to talk about, but I feel a devotion to this way of being in the world. And so that devotion, over the years, we express it in so many ways. in this building and outside of it, and it's just in my heart, you know. So devotion to the Buddha way and to an open-hearted way of being in the world. There's certain phrases in the teachings and the poetry that we, you know, chant in our zendo, and after we chant the names of the women ancestors, there's a dedication that says thanks them, or that acknowledges their open-hearted devotion to the all-inclusive way. And those words are really meaningful to me, the open-hearted part, the devotion part, and particularly the all-inclusive way. And it's in, you know, it's what helps me move through everybody, you know, those everybody but my ex-husband moments, or everything except, you know, I'll look at everything and include everything except what's happening in the North Dakota pipeline struggle. Everything but that, you know. So to me, the all-inclusive way is not only everyone, but everything that presents itself in front of us. So there's a few key things about ordination, and they're scary. I mean, to me, I've had to find my way to to understand them and have them not be scary. Things like renunciation, leaving home, vows. So, you know, it's funny. There's this way of trying to find out what those things mean. And what I can talk about is what they mean now. But what I feel really strongly is that if I decide, okay, this is what renunciation means to me, and then I type it up and I, you know, put it in my pocket, then it's no good to me. It always has to be an open question. I want to tell a little bit of a story, especially because my dearest friends Joe and Sherry are here, who we've lived with on our organic farm for 35 years. And part of, basically, what the teachings say we're renouncing is our self-concern, our self-clinging. And that doesn't mean not to be concerned for oneself. But we shared this land, and we're in a community for all those years. You know, year after year, kind of what we came to see had to be the basis of our community was a part of the way I think of renunciation, which is learning to say what's important to my farm partners and my neighbors and the people that we're doing this with I have to care about that as much as I care about what I want. And so over the years, it was just a difficult but, you know, really centering way to be with each other. And we've made so many mistakes, and we're in a difficult situation now in our community, but that's the basis, and that's the renunciation. It's like, it's an opening up to everyone's well-being is my job, and it's all of our jobs, everyone's well-being. It's hard not to see it as a form of denial or asceticism, but it's really Can I renounce what's holding me back? Can I renounce what I'm holding on so tightly that it's not allowing me to be free? So, I think it's living life as it is. To me, that's what renunciation's about. And it's also about living in the unedited version of my story and my life. I had a really amazing experience. I won't tell a lot about it, but working with a particular story of my life in a group of people, and then part of what they did is they had us work with clay. Because, you know, we wrote and then we talked, but they had us, okay, so make your story, just make your story. What does it look like? And then we came back and worked it again, and it really allowed me to see. There was a moment at which I looked at what I'd created, and it was the unedited story. And it wasn't what I thought, you know, what I thought I was creating in my pretty version. It was the truth of the story. And so, you know, I think that's part of the work that we do, is to see the places where we kind of edit out what we don't want to see. And then leaving home was a huge, confusing concept for me. And then there's all these stories. There's all these stories of the ancestors and leaving home and locking their mothers out. And the Buddha himself leaving his family. And it was, you know, I didn't like it. And it's difficult and painful to me to say, well, what is that about? How is that not, you know, ducking out, or really something for me to come to terms with. We have a big messy family, lots of kids and grandkids, and they're all falling apart most of the time. And it's, you know, we're kind of their stability. And so just recently, in all the years of thinking about this whole leaving home scenario, I was able to see, have that be meaningful to me in such a different way. And the way that I can see it now, that I really makes sense to me and is beautiful, is not focusing on what I'm leaving behind. In fact, I'm not really leaving anything behind. It's not India, and, you know, it's not hundreds of years ago. It's a different context for us. But what's important to me about the concept of leaving home is this. I got this image of how we circle the wagons. You know that saying, like in the old days, and you're out in the frontier, and there's danger out there. And so we circle the wagons, and we're protecting. And what's inside, that's what we protect. So what's inside is ours, and what's outside is all the bad people and all the bad stuff. And so how about thinking of home leaving? And so, you know, that's like we're circling, we're protecting those within, we're guarding against those without. How about home leaving as this, as uncircling the wagons? Home leaving as this, it's not that this is mine and that's out there, it's that all of it I invite in. That's like all-inclusive way. Home leaving not as walking away from something, but as inviting everything in. Which sounds good, but it's not that easy to do. But I think, you know, I do think that that's a deeper part of what leaving home means. It means, you know, opening this. Just a couple more concepts, and then I'm going to stop. We couldn't tell how long we'd be talking, and Chuck, of course, said, just keep talking. Don't worry, but I don't want to do that. But I want to say something also about vulnerability. This is about vulnerability, you know. This is about, in a way, is about vulnerability. It's kind of being naked with your people and with all people, in a way, you know. It's coming into the Zendo, which we could move pretty gracefully around this space, right? Years, and we know how to do everything. It feels so good. One of the things that was really beautiful about this vulnerability is really made me think, wow, everybody that walks in here for the first time, this is what it's like. You know, you're curious and you walk in this beautiful space, but you don't know when to bow or which direction to turn or how to sit or what two bells means. And so, you know, all the times that we can allow ourselves to be vulnerable in a lot of ways, you know, in many ways, I think just help us connect and open to other people in situations where they feel awkward or vulnerable. And this is such a small thing. I mean, imagine the vulnerability of not having a home, you know? Or having a sick child that you don't know how you can get help for. So, there's something real personal about vulnerability that I discovered. We had the opportunity, I'm in a chaplaincy program now in UPI Zen Center where we moved to Santa Fe, and we had the joy of working with Frank Ostaseski. I know some of you know, and I know Edie knows him, and wonderful teacher. And he talked about cultivating the courage of vulnerability and how important that is, and that it takes a lot of courage. And kind of in reflecting on that, he also taught a lot about the courage to fail. And then how important it is to let ourselves fail, to like take enough chances and let ourselves fail so that we can look at it, and we can look at it with our community, and we can learn something about how we hurt other people or where we close down. And what I know about myself is I will line those ducks up till they're out the door because I want to have it all under control, you know. I want to fix get everything shaped up so that I'm not going to fall on my face. And you know, studying with him, it's like if all my effort is going to not falling on my face, then how am I going to cultivate the courage of vulnerability, and how am I going to have any freedom? How am I going to, you know, really show up freshly if I'm so busy trying to keep it under control? So that's a lifetime of work for me, but I think there's many ways in which being ordained and becoming a priest, it's not, you know, it's like you got more stuff covering you up, but you're, in a way, more vulnerable and more naked. And that's a good thing. So I'm going to skip over something so that Chuck has lots of time to talk here.
Everyone knows it's a really good practice for me to shut up. It is so unusual that I don't talk. So please, go on.
So, okay. I'll only skip some things, but I'll say a few more things. A couple years ago, I think, Kokyo had sent me this huge document, collection of writings about becoming a priest from the Dhammapada, like from the very first writings to lots of modern people, and all reflections on ordination and leaving home and renunciation, that a lot of really beautiful things. And something, that one short thing that I wanted to share because I thought it was so lovely, is this from was actually in the Windbell, an article by Lewis Richmond called Ways to Be a Soto Priest in America. And he says, once when Suzuki Roshi was asked what it meant to be a priest in America, he replied, "I don't know." We must all concur. At the moment we are, we might say, in the Wild West phase of Soto Zen in America. There's some discomfort in this situation, perhaps, but we also ought to find a way to enjoy it. In 100 years, if Buddhism has survived and prospered here, people will imagine that they do know what it means to be a priest. And then they'll have a different kind of problem. Until then, let us, in the spirit of Zen's early Chinese founders, remain flexible, creative, and open-minded. Who knows what might happen? So, not only did I think that was really sweet, but also, you know, there's the courage of just not knowing. I mean, there's no way. It's going to be... It's like these other words that I was talking about. If I think that I know and figure out what it means to wear these robes, then I'm kind of done, you know? It has to stay alive, and it has to stay an inquiry. Oh, there's another really good story that I want to tell because it's important, and then I will stop. I'm not sure, sometime last year in one of the teachings or lectures, someone was sharing a story about Roshi Bernie Glassman, and it's a very important story for us to hear today, as, you know, the news keeps rolling in about things that are being rescinded. And and the story is this. Roshi Bernie Glassman was talking, he was teaching about compassion to a large audience, and he was talking about Avalokiteshvara's many, many arms, and on each, to alleviate the suffering of all beings, and with an eye on each arm, and, you know, the ability of, you know, her ability to kind of soothe and calm and heal the world that this figure represented. And, you know, someone in the audience said, you know, that's lovely, but there's all these problems and all this suffering, and I just have two hands. And so what Bernie said, ask this immense audience to do, is what I'm going to ask this smaller audience to do right now. Everyone raise your hand. Mm-hmm. And it, you know, it really is who we are and what it's all about. Because we do have 100 hands. So, in closing my part, I'd like to read a poem, because that's kind of my thing. I always like to read poems at the end of Dharma Talks, and Chuck's going to share a poem also. And this is my thank you at the end. I told you I had a thank you at the beginning and a thank you at the end. And this is a poem from our beloved friend, Brian Bielfeld. Thank you for your work. If you want to surprise a server as you hand her your tip, say, thank you for your work. To the barista who draws flowers and hot milk, thank you for your work. When the checkout clerk asks, did you find everything you were looking for? Watch their eyes and think, now I have. Thank you for your work. To the shiny red bicycle whose spinning wheels keeps me from hitting the hard pavement, thank you for your work. the soft bed that protects me and keeps me warm till morning comes. Thank you for your work. The thrush that hides all winter in the thick bushes, when spring comes, struts out onto a tree limb and proceeds to play its flute. Thank you for your work. To the hot ball of sun, always there, whether we can see it or not. Thank you for your work. Thank you.
Should I use a microphone or just broadcast? That's what I thought.
What about the recording, though? Put it down here. Yeah.
Well, I didn't read Nanette's talk. I saw her working away. And we are so different. And those of you who know us know that. And that's not a bad thing. It's a very good thing. Mm-hmm. I have always thought that opposites attract.
Yep.
And here we are. I, too, the very first thing I thought of was gratitude. We're held in two sanghas now. We're still members of Santa Cruz Zen Center. We still support this Zen Center. And we live 1,200 miles away. And we joined and support Upaya Zen Center, and it's a lovely place. And when we first were getting ready to move, it was really difficult for me. We had changed a house that should have been bulldozed probably 40 years ago. We changed it into a nice, warm little place. And it's not fancy, but it's lovely. It's wonderful. And we had to do a lot of work to make it livable, because when we first moved into it, we had 5 children, and the youngest was not 1 yet, and we had 2 rooms. We had a living room that we added a sink to, because we had no running water and we had no electricity. And so it was Coleman stove and kerosene lanterns for a while, and candles. And it's really hard to study with that kind of light. But it's what we had. And when I first dated Nanette, actually I would ride out to the farm on an old BMW motorcycle on a road that shouldn't have been driven on a motorcycle. And she lived in a tent in the edge of the woods. And that was nice. But when we then we moved into the barn. It was a big, beautiful barn there, and we lived on the second floor of the barn for a while, just like Joe and Sherry had.
Yeah.
And then this house came available, and we looked at it, and there had been livestock kept in the house. And bins of winter squash, some rotting, that had been kept in the house. So I think you're getting the picture. It was rustic, to say the least. And we changed it over time, and it took a lot of time and a lot of energy, and thank goodness I was a lot younger then. So we made it happen, and we raised our 5 kids, and our youngest, when he went away to college, we always had an outhouse. And so when our youngest went away to college, he's now 31, when he went away to college, we got a septic tank, we got a bathtub, we converted one of the bedrooms into a bathroom. And so he came back and said, "Why did you wait so long?"
And you said,
I think he was really embarrassed about living conditions. But I have great gratitude for my partners at the farm, and I think over time it actually got harder instead of easier, because it got more complicated. And I have the greatest gratitude to especially all the priests here. Nanette and I were head student here, which is called Shuso. And this was in 2012, and Kokyo gave us this role, and I was clueless. Nanette was Shuso first, and then I followed right after her. And I kept saying to the various priests that, you know, I don't think I could do this like Nanette. And they really woke me up, you know. They said, no, you have the wrong idea. You need to just be you and step forward. And I loved initially in the Zen Center, the baseline was just show up. It's still that way. And the people that show up keep showing up. And then they're assigned roles. You learn to be a Doan. You learn to be a Jiko. You learn all these great roles and forms in the Zendo that impact you in a way that you would never know. That make you feel like you're a part of this space and you're a part of this community and you just end up loving everybody. And so I have this tremendous gratitude for Jean, who went through all this work in the preparation of ordination for us, and then continued with more work dedicated to us, to helping us manage fabric and be okay with being embarrassed and be okay with humiliation and realize that it's just putting one foot in front of the other. And so there's a beautiful simplicity about practice, that it is just showing up. It is doing your best as consistently as you can. And it's learning to think of others all the time. I'm grateful to Patrick because he started what they call Global Sangha here, which is feeding the Homeless Garden Project and the River Street Shelter every Friday, 9 months of the year? So every Friday.
11 months.
11 months, okay. Sorry for cutting you short. So when I retired from teaching alternative high school in 06, we really ramped up practice. We started showing up every day. And it just continued. And so when Patrick started this cooking idea, I thought it sounded great. And so I jumped in and I cooked with him for 7 years. And it wasn't every Friday, but it was almost every Friday. And I got to look at my ideas about what homelessness is. And I grew up in the 60s, so I've had my rounds with lots of different drugs. And I always kind of stereotyped the homeless as people who were either drug addicted, alcoholic, mentally ill. You know, I had it pretty much categorized. I thought I had it pretty figured out. And then when we started, we would cook and we would deliver the food to the homeless garden and we would serve them first, but then we would serve ourselves and we would sit down and eat. And so we would start to get to know people. And here was an engineer who lost his job and then he lost his house and he lost his family. And now he lived in a car. And so my ideas were staring me in the face of how I judged, how I categorized, how I thought I knew what was up. And I was just so foolish and ignorant that I had to learn. I had to take in stories of people and get to know them a little bit and realize that I needed more empathy. I certainly needed more compassion. And part of that role of serving others actually builds that for you. It allows you to see truth. It allows you to look at your judgments and back off of them and learn that you're making stuff up all the time. I hope you don't mind me saying this, but Nanette and I went through a period of time where we would say, "You're just making shit up," you know? And it was the absolute truth. It was what, and it's what everybody does. I hate to break it to you, but you know, it's what everybody does. And thank goodness, Zazen, part of meditation is watching your mind continually. Seeing how off track you go, how you daydream, how you do whatever. You think about all kinds of things in meditation. And if you're paying attention, you notice and you bring yourself back to right now. Stanhope and I taught meditation at an alternative high school where I used to work for, what was that, almost a year?
Yeah, it was a full year.
So that was part of putting kids in touch with how they think and how they can actually kind of take charge of their life if they pay attention. And they don't have to make a lot of mistakes necessarily, but they can learn to pay attention. I did a similar program. I was invited by two Vipassana friends of mine who have a different practice, but one was the ex-principal of the high school that I worked at, and he said, "Chuck, I think you would really like going to the jail." Yep. And sure enough, I loved it. And it was another every Friday event for 3 years, teaching mindfulness meditation at the jail, at the county jail right here in Santa Cruz. And in that 3 years, I think I saw five of my former students. And instead of judging them, thank goodness I had evolved just enough to look at their circumstances and realize their circumstances haven't changed in 20 years. I knew them when they were 17, now they're 37, and their circumstances are the same as they were when they were teenagers. And it partly broke my heart, but at the same time I had clear understanding that, oh, they haven't been able to get out of the rut that they've been in for a really long time. And so they were always grateful that we would show up, and they would say so, and they would always thank us profusely. And then a lot of them I would see later when they got out of jail. And they would say, "Oh, you guys were really helpful, and we really looked forward to seeing you and learning some things about how we think and how we act." And most of them had that ever-popular teenage knee-jerk reaction of, you say something mean to them, they'll put a fist in your face. You know? That instant anger, instant reaction, and through mindfulness meditation, they learn to slow that reaction down and look at consequences and look at reactions and realize that they had some control in their life if they really paid attention. So, great gratitude for the various avenues that have been given to me to widen my practice, to maybe touch the hearts of a few people. And it's not like it's a real big deal in terms of, oh, I really changed the world. Because I look at the world and it scares the heck out of me. It really does, you know, and I was reading from some of the practice period material. In fact, I started reading it when we were in New Mexico. Joanna Macy's book, just fabulous. And it was published in 2012, and yet it is so timely to exactly what's going on today and to the evolution of our destroying our earth. But instead of being scared, she gives you ammunition. She gives you insight into what can you do. And it's like the illustration Nanette just gave with all the hands. You know, you're not alone. You're not alone. There are other people that care. There, you know, I mean, look at the Women's March, for goodness sakes. We scrolled through on the computer just before we came here this evening, and we looked at all of these major cities in the United States, in Europe, in Canada, in South America. It was amazing. It was phenomenal, and it was really inspiring. And it just, it gave me a message that with that kind of power, with that kind of integrity, with that kind of passion for doing the right thing and for protecting each other and for caring about each other, that maybe the future that I see as bleak, especially environmentally, maybe it's not so. Maybe I'm making judgments again too soon. And maybe I just need to rally myself and be as helpful as I can be in that movement to make things better for everyone. Gee, I jotted down all these notes and I haven't used them yet. But we're almost out of time. And I really would like... I know almost everybody in the room. And I'm really grateful that you're here. And those that don't know us have now got a glimpse of what we're about and what we're like and kind of how our path has unfolded. We actually went to Tassajara for nearly 30 years, and we never had a regular practice until we landed in this Zendo. And then as soon as we landed, that was it. It was the place to be. And we found home. And I did want to say that leaving home and leaving home is what it has been for us. We left our home here in Santa Cruz a year ago. And that was really hard in a lot of ways. It was difficult to leave Sangha. This Zendo just feels like home. We've been here so much. And then leaving home, becoming a priest, was another leaving home. And that one will unfold for the rest of our life. And I thought it was so odd. I realize it's just me, but I always thought that down the line, as you get older, you know, you supposedly become wiser. And it's amazing to me, I'm 71, and it's like I'm learning new stuff all the time. And I just never thought that that was going to be true. I thought, you know, at some point you really get your act together. Not this one. And thank goodness my literal better half makes space for exactly who I am. And she makes me feel okay about who I am. And it's the first time in my life, now it's been 30 plus years, that I ever felt that way about myself. That, you know what, I am okay just like I am. As odd as that might be, it's okay. And I'll tell you, that is so liberating. It's hard to express how remarkable that is. So I'm also very grateful to the one right next to me. She charts a lot of the course. She's good at it. I'm learning all the time from her, too. I think sometimes we learn from each other. Maybe sometimes I just humor her. But it's been an excellent team effort, and there are still difficulties with our kids and trying to help them navigate as much as we can. But we keep realizing that we have to keep letting that one go too. It's not necessarily fully our charge, even though we would like it to be sometimes. Especially when we see poor decision making or, you know, kids making it harder on themselves than it needs to be. I wanted to, even though I didn't read any of my notes, I acquired a really good book And I would like to read one of Ziggy's poems. And, I really got into it today. I read almost all of it, and it was just so much fun and so beautiful. You are an eloquent writer, young lady, and I'm so grateful that you gifted us with this. And I just wanted to share a tiny bit of it with the rest of you. And now you have an idea, those of you who didn't know me, now you have an idea of what I was talking about with regard to, it's hard to stop talking when I get home. Aria. An orange disc falls into the sea, its slow descent, like the elder koi, unaware of its brilliance. Earth wobbles in its orbit, my mother struggles to stand, this tide pushing me, pulling her, while dusk pours into night, full into waning, a crescent moon hangs in the window like an aria. Thank you, everyone, for coming this evening. We're both really appreciative, and we're fortunate enough to be able to be here for almost a whole another month. We wanted to attend this practice period along with our ordination, and it's been a wonderful opportunity to see people, to touch in with people we haven't seen for a really long time, to just be present here and to take in this wonderful, wonderful environment. And a lot of you who were just starting to practice here when we were leaving, and others that have come since then, I think are already having that sensation of welcome. And I'll tell you, we got a similar kind of thing at Upaya, even though it's a gigantic place. It's a lovely practice place, and Rob told me before we went that it's a combination of Southwest and Japanese. I had a hard time visualizing that, even though I didn't say it. But he was dead on. He was absolutely. It's lovely. Thank you so much.
Delusions are exhaustible.